Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for joining me on Coast to Coast AM. Sitting in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader. Well, we're back at it tonight with another look at more of the Bible's histories and mysteries. Interesting aspects of history and different things. You'd think after all of these years, most of the mysteries would have been cracked, especially in the dawning of the technological age. We should have learned all we could possibly learn from the Bible and its stories, but it seems that is always changing. There are still new things to be discovered, new things to be tested, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. A little later on in the show, the Ark of the Covenant, which has to be one of probably the most extraordinary artifacts in history. So tonight, in the second part of our show for the last 2 hours, historical detective Graham Phillips will present evidence that this remarkable relic really existed and was discovered by the Crusader Knights, the Templars, during the Middle Ages and brought back to Europe. And Phillips now believes he knows where it's located. So we're going to talk about the Lost Ark of the Covenant. We'll go on our own little Raiders expedition this evening. And for the first 2 hours, we're going to be joined by a couple of experts talking about the Jordan Codices, which are an ancient set of 70 lead tablets that just may change the world's view of biblical history. We'll talk with religious scholars and Egyptologist David Elkington. We're going to discuss new evidence that suggests this 2,000-year-old tablets are genuine and may include the earliest portrait of Jesus Christ. A lot of great stuff coming up. I'm going to be back with you on New Year's Eve, and I'll tell you what, I'd love your input. What type of topics and guests would you like to hear as we ring in the new year together? What things would you like to cover? Should we look at a year in review and look to what's coming for the next year? Do you have specific topics? You can always email me, dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. And give me your thoughts, insights, and perceptions. I'd love to hear from you. And if any time during the show you have questions, feel free to email them to me, and I will try to work them in throughout the show as well. And we'll be opening up phone lines throughout the show if you have questions for our guests. So sit back, relax, turn down the lights, turn up the radio, and we'll be right back right here on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Welcome back to the show. This is the best in overnight talk radio. Coast to Coast AM is on the air. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. Joining me here in the first 2 hours, David Elkington. He's the author of the highly acclaimed academic thesis on the resonance and acoustical origins of religion. David is primarily an Egyptologist, specializing in Egypt-Palestinian links that have inevitably drawn him into the field of biblical studies. Now, he's lectured at universities all over the world and written many papers on ancient history and linguistics. He has in his possession two of the metal books, which were actually smuggled out of Jordan. His goal is to return them to Jordan so that they can properly be displayed in a museum. Tonight, we'll talk about the Jordan Codices with our guest, David Elkington. David, thank you for joining me this evening.
Good evening, Dave.
What a fascinating aspect of these stories. I mean, are you surprised, as I said in the opening of the show, here we are 2,000 years in the history of the Bible lore and legends and parables that are taught to us through Christianity, and yet there still seems to be more to learn from things out there, and we're always uncovering new topics and new aspects of this. Does that surprise you?
It does in one way, and it doesn't in another, because I think that, humanity is prone to boredom, and if we discover everything, we'll just get bored, and goodness knows what would happen,
right.
if that were finally to be achieved. So it's quite a good thing that we have things to surprise us from the past. But I have to say, in terms of the codices, we have a codex in our possession, which was loaned to us by the Department of Antiquities, Jordan, in 2011. And it's a profoundly beautiful object, and it's quite interesting, the discovery of these books, if you want to call them that, very, very early books at that, actually offers a huge amount of hope, and as well as insight into the origins of Christianity, and a lot of hope for those who have the faith.
Well, talk to us a little bit about these. What are the codices?
Well, I must say, when I first saw very low resonance images of them on an email shown us by a journalist back in 2007, I thought, these are very strange looking books, because I thought perhaps they were made of leather, as most codices generally are. But when he told us that they were made purely of lead, I found it very difficult to sort of to believe, really.
Right.
And a few weeks later, we were introduced to the Bedouin who had located these things, and he had one which he wore around his neck. And yes, I mean, definitely lead. You could feel it by the very weight. And the fact that there are 70 of these things, and probably more, they're at the moment kept in Israel and in Jordan. There's lead books coming in from other areas too. And obviously, this is a very large hoard of books that have been found at the cave site in northern Jordan.
Okay, so they were found at a cave site. Can you walk us through that? How did this finding come about, and how long ago? What was the condition of this finding when they stumbled upon it?
The story goes that there was a massive rainstorm in the area. The cave site itself is a massive gorge. It's the most spectacularly beautiful place. So as you can imagine, there's a very thin layer of ground soil, although it's a very lush territory. But of course, the rain comes along and it washes away the ground soil on a regular basis. Two chaps out looking for their goats. They'd seen where the rain had washed away the soil to reveal a couple of rocks with literally Paleo-Hebrew tabs inscribed on them, which is the X shape that you might see in the English alphabet. So literally, X marks the spot. They remove these rock caps. They look in, and there you have wonderful things. We have caches of books in sealed lead boxes, and we have other things besides. And we finally located the site in 2009, and we went back with the Jordanian Department of Antiquities in 2011, and they were very taken aback by the sheer size of the place, and the fact that we were the first Westerners ever to go there. It was an extraordinary privilege to be involved.
No. What is the significant relevance of the location of this finding? Is there anything particular to why this cache would have been hidden in this location?
Well, for your viewers, if they look at the map of the Middle East, if they look at the area where the Sea of Galilee is, they'll see that the line of the River Jordan divides Jordan on the east from Israel on the west. And the site is not far off the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee on the Jordanian side. Now, in biblical terms, we know that Jesus would dip his toes into the city of Jerusalem, because he was a fairly controversial character even in his day, and then he would actually leave Jerusalem to go to his headquarters, which we suspect was on the Jordanian side and very likely to be somewhere near or in the cave site. So this is a very, very special place and a very important place.
Do we know, or who can we speculate is responsible for making these?
Well, again, it's a curious question. You know, We think, and looking at the iconography, looking at the language, looking at the very fact that they are sealed books, that we've had a few scrolls amongst the collection, but not many. I mean, literally, I've got photographs of three or four, and they're very tiny. But you know, the overall body of the collection are in the codex form, the early book form. And that suggests that these, therefore, were made by early Hebrew Christians. And when we look at the iconography, when we look at the language used upon them, but furthermore, when we look at the codex that is absolutely the core of the collection with its face on the front cover, the conclusion you have to come to is that they were made by early Hebrew Christians, by Nazarenes, at the very beginnings of Christianity. And, of course, recently we performed further tests on the books, and we can now date them with confidence to the first and second centuries.
Very interesting. Now, are there any you know, with this kind of history and these books existing, I know that they've found other scrolls and other books of the Bible. And in the Bible, those books even refer to each other, but they're not part of the canonical Bible that we're used to. Does the Bible reference these codices at all?
We think there's mention of aspects of the collection, most surely. And I think the most obvious reference is Revelation 5:1, in which we have Jesus opening the seven seals of a book. Some people read it in Revelation as the seven seals of a scroll, but the original language used by St. John in the writing of Revelation uses the Greek word biblion, which can only and should only ever be translated as book. So there we have, you know, the book of the book of Revelation. And of course, it's the book, of course, that as each seal opens, you have the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And then, of course, you have, you know, the great rebellion against, you know, the powers of evil. And then, of course, you have the final, you know, coming to paradise. So that's a very, very obvious reference. But there are also references in the Old Testament as well as the non-canonical literature. We've got references in the Book of Esdras. Your listeners might want to go to 2 Esdras 14. They can also go to Chronicles 1 and 2. And we also have references in 2 Maccabees. But in terms of the non-canonical, the other textual evidence, in amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have 11Q Melchizedek, which appears to mention something of this ilk. And of course, I must mention too that the great and eminent scholar, the late Hugh Schonfield, also mentioned that the biggest of the largest, the most intact of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Damascus document, also mentioned a small book made of metal called the Book of the Hagu, which translates as the Book of the Holy One, which seems to be, again, another reference to the book mentioned in Revelation. So, yes, there are quite a few mentions. And, of course, you know, we're reviewing and analyzing that at the moment.
Now, are there chances, you know, I mean, when the Bible was written and these stories were conveyed, many copies seem to have been made and then squirreled away and hidden. Have there been any other possible copies of the same text and stories, images that you found in these codices that have appeared since their finding, or that you found fragments of them throughout history showing up?
As far as we know, there are a couple of connections there, but of course, translation is ongoing at the present time. But I can say that the books, in what they say thus far, are quite unlike anything we've come across. They're very largely ritualistic. They mention all manner of liturgical points, and they seem to be based very firmly in the tradition of the temple. And they actually, you know, describe the temple both in terms of words and in terms of illustrations. So they offer an awful lot of insight into some of the lost aspects of the temple in terms of how people worshipped there, what was in it, and precisely what the shape and the form of God took during the first century period.
Do we know who it is that made these books specifically? Is there, you know, like what we would consider today a watermark or a hallmark to let you know that it is this grouping, it's this gathering of people?
It's a difficult one. It's much like the Dead Sea Scrolls with the arguments over, you know, were they made by the Essenes or gathered together by the shores of the Dead Sea, or did they come all over from all over the land of Israel and were therefore gathered together to be hidden away? I would suggest that, given the iconography and the script, that the books, those which are certainly first century, were written by Nazarene Hebrew Christians, because the book form itself suggests that. And I would, you know, obviously we need to do more research, we need to undertake further analysis on this, but it's also what they contain and what they say that kind of points in that direction. I mean, I can give you one translation we have. We've got from Proverbs 19:1, we've got better the poor walking in integrity than one perverse of speech who is a fool. And that's a really interesting point, because it seems to be talking about the figure of wisdom in the temple, and it seems to be talking about the approach of wisdom. And it's a curious thing, because as the Gnostic groups, who many Christians believe to be heretics, would say that, you know, there is only one single sin, and that sin is ignorance. So therefore, if you have knowledge, you become less ignorant, you become less sinful. And that's interesting, because, of course, knowledge is a living, breathing thing. It gives you wisdom. And, of course, wisdom is a figure who we can find throughout the Bible. And, I mean, look at the beginning of the Song of Songs, which talks about this beautiful woman, this figure. I am black, but I am beautiful. This gorgeous woman who, you know, has had a hymn about her written by none other than King Solomon himself. It's talking about the approach to wisdom. It's talking about its fine feminine forms. It's talking about how wisdom itself raises us beyond being merely human. So in that sense, you've got a restoration, if you like, of old temples concepts that have been preserved into the first century period.
Isn't that interesting? Now, can you go back for just a second? You mentioned that they consider knowledge enlightening, and that you should encourage knowledge and seeking answers and questions, correct? That was part of what they believed would escalate you?
Yes, indeed. I mean, the Jews and the Jewish Christians, if you want to call them that, you know, they were logical people. There was nothing illogical about them. You know, they believed that God created the universe and everything in it, and therefore he must have created the rational too. So their approach is rationalist, you know. And this is why they held books and knowledge in such high esteem.
The reason I ask that again is, you know, that, you know, it's in Genesis, and I'm sorry, I'm not great at quoting. I think it was in Genesis 2 where they talk about the rules, right? And you can use of this garden anything you want, but stay free of the, you know, tree of knowledge. Doesn't it seem strange that right there God's saying, leave knowledge alone. Just leave this knowledge of good and evil, leave it be, everything else is yours, but yet the belief system is the more knowledge we have, the closer we get to God, the closer we are to understanding that, and that it's, you know, we're almost a sinner not to try to educate ourselves.
This is why the books were actually cast in lead, so they couldn't be re-edited. And this is what you have with books of the Bible, is that a large part of them have actually been re-edited, reshaped, reformed in order to suit the opinions of the times in which they have been retranslated or reformulated. And you can see a contradiction directly when you compare the book of Exodus to the book of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, Moses is on the mountain. In fact, he's actually in the mountain, and he cannot see God. God passes by, a shadow in the night. But if you go to the same episode in Exodus, Moses sees God face to face. So you have there an example of the rewriting of certain texts. You have, you know, that seem to stand in contradiction to each other. So you're absolutely right. I mean, sometimes you get the impression that, you know, the idea of God saying, oh, no, you mustn't sort of eat of the tree of knowledge is a bit like a sort of, you know, a tabloid newspaper editor saying, we're going to give you a limited amount of knowledge here because knowledge is a very dangerous thing. And I think that's possibly what Genesis is saying. You know, if you're going to actually learn, if you're going to find anything out, you've got to make sure you get both sides of the argument before you go forward. Otherwise, you could be sort of taken off up the beaten track and led to an absolute dead end. We have to be very careful. Knowledge is dangerous.
That, you know, I love that you're saying that, you know, even the books kind of contradict themselves, but isn't that the way? I mean, we even find that today. That's why key eyewitnesses are sometimes hard to deal with in a court of law, because two people can be standing looking at the same story and see totally different aspects. Could it be that in the book of Exodus, the story is told one way because it's through the perspective of, and through the book of Deuteronomy, it's told through the perspective of, and there's, you know, subtle changes and differences, or, you know, if Moses is relating what happened to him to the scribe, perhaps he was not as forthcoming at first because he wanted to, you know, God passed by me, I didn't even notice him at this point. And then after he, realized and revealed what was really going on, that he was more open in subsequent books of the Bible.
There's a classic example in the First World War. Apparently, the general gave at the front instructions: send for reinforcements. We're going to advance. And by the time the message got to the back of the line, it said, "Send for three and fourpence. We're going to advance." and in a sense, what you have here is exactly what happens in historical documentation when it has actually been subject to scribal error and then, of course,
right,
you know, scribal misinterpretation.
Well, we'll continue this. We have to take a break, David. Hold tight. Looking at biblical history, we're talking about the Jodan Codices. We'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. Grab your fedoras. Grab hold of your whips, your leather coat, because a little later we're going in search of the lost ark. Graham Phillips will join me in hours 3 and 4 this evening as we talk about the Ark of the Covenant and where it may finally rest. We'll talk about that and more. We'll take your calls as well. And in the remainder of this hour and next hour, we will continue speaking about the Jodan Codices. We'll talk more about these interesting pieces of history that have surfaced and what it means to theology, to biblical understanding, Christianity, and more. And why have more people not heard of this? And the people that have, what are they saying about it? What are the naysayers and the people that are championing it say? We'll find out more from our guest as we continue this exploration. Remember, if you've missed any part of tonight's show, you missed last night's show, or any of the great topics we have here, and you're kicking yourself, you're driving in the car, you hear something, and a week later you're thinking, I wish I remembered what that was. Who was that guest? Where was that information coming from? Well, we've got it all in one comprehensive place for you. Go visit coasttocoastam.com. Coasttocoastam.com is your online resource for all of the great content you hear on the show. Photographs, interesting data, information, news, live chats. And if you become a Coast Insider, that's a one-year subscription. It breaks down to just 15 cents a day and gives you access to 5 years of past radio archives. So you can hear all of the great topics that you've missed and the ones you want to revisit all at your fingertips for 15 cents a day. And it is the holiday season. It'd be a perfect gift to give to your friends, relatives, and coworkers that you know enjoy the same type of topic. It'll give you more to talk about over the water cooler at work, too. So go check it out. Become a Coast to Coast Insider by visiting coasttocoastam.com. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader, and do me a favor, go check out a new online resource that I've been working on and a part of. It's called The Dark Zone, and you can check it out at thedarkzone.tv. That's thedarkzone.tv. I'm working along with some of the people you've seen on other paranormal TV series, and we're coming together with a comprehensive new look at the paranormal. There's new programming, new shows, video blogs, stories, and more. We'd love for you to go check it out. So during the break, give it a look at thedarkzone.tv. We'll be back with more. I'm Dave Schrader. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the show. David Elkington, my guest right now, as we talk about the Jodan Codices. How is it that more people have not heard about this, David? What's going on, and why the suppression?
Well, you know, this is really curious. When we first made the announcement in March 2011, we did so with the support of the Jordanian government, and along with Dr. Ziad Al-Saad, who was then the Director General of the Department of Antiquities. News of discovery actually went all around the world and was greeted with significant excitement. And then the Jordanian government had promised to follow up with an official announcement of their own. But then 8 days after we actually announced that discovery, which we did, by the way, to prevent the codices from being sold on the black antiquities market, 8 days later, the Oxford classicist, Dr. Peter Toneman of Wadham College, Oxford, dismissed the entire collection of codices as fake, as modern forgeries, in an article he wrote for the Times Literary Supplement, which is based in London. Now, the story of this.
What was his basis for making that type of claim?
You're going to be amazed by this.
Okay.
About 8 months beforehand, we'd sent him one very low resolution image of what appeared to be a copper codex that had been forwarded to us by the Bedouin Hassan from Israel. We'd never had access, physical access, to this codex. We only had the photograph. And across the top of the codex, there was a Greek inscription, which I could read quite well, but I needed really to get the expert view. And I was put in touch with Dr. Toneman, who said that in his view, it was actually a modern forgery, and therefore, you know, we shouldn't go any further. and we thanked him for his work. And I'd suggested a few things prior to that, that if it was real, we think we know where the metal would come from and so on and so forth. And then much to our horror, he wrote this article in the Times Rishi Supplement basing his assessment purely upon that one low-resolution photograph. So, of course, the damage it did was just immense. I mean, everybody started then jumping onto the bandwagon saying that they were fakes and forgeries and even giving me credit for actually having faked these things myself. But what Dr. Toneman did not know is that, you know, since then, we've actually, you know, made huge strides. We had by that stage undertaken a series of tests that had shown the lead codices to be beyond a doubt of Roman provenance in, you know, in terms of dating. But we've since found out that from colleagues of Toneman's at Oxford that in fact the reason he made his statement was actually that he saw the codices as a threat to his faith, his Catholic faith. Now he'd be mortified to know that one eminent biblical scholar we have on our side is Professor Bernhard Lang, who also happens to be a Catholic priest and has no problem with the codices whatsoever, having seen all of the data. Now, as you can imagine, you know, going beyond
Can I stop you real quick, David? That has got to be extremely frustrating that someone that has that kind of power can look at a low-resolution scan of something, deem that it's going to be a problem for his belief in faith and system, and just shut it down with, you know, first of all, that calls into credibility his, or calls into effect his credibility, that this was the extent of the work that he put into this. Wow, that's extremely disheartening to hear that it fell apart that quickly from somebody that took no time to actually scientifically study this item.
Well, this is the problem. He didn't ask for any further analysis. He didn't ask for any further data. Just dismissed it on those grounds. And since then, others are coming out to say that he was over hasty. And if Dr. Toneman is actually listening to this show, I'd like to state now that you staked your career on this twice, both in the London Times Literary Supplement and on BBC television. You staked your career on this. I would like to see if you are a man of your word. It is time for you to step down, because the damage you have wrought to scholarship and to your own reputation is immense, and I think it's time to leave. The other side of this as well is that Dr. Toneman wrote in his article of factories of forgery within Jordan. Now, we spoke with Professor Ziad Al-Saad, who is not only a very, very decent and honorable human being, but a very great expert and probably the greatest archaeometallurgist on the planet. And he was very, very angry by this because he said, you know, the Jordanians look after their archaeological sites with express care. And they are, you know, they have to. They rely on the tourist income for their economy. And here we have, you know, a very curt dismissal of the 90,000 sites in Jordan of archaeological importance because of factories of forgery which do not exist. We know that they exist in Syria, where they are not policed, but in Jordan they are policed. And I'm afraid to say, terrible that it is, that this comment is just the tip of the iceberg, because Jordanian scholars who have looked at the codices have been totally ignored by the West. And I'm afraid to say it's down to institutional racism. Quite shocking.
Very shocking. Well, okay, so we have somebody that weighs in that has no physical connection to this item, has never seen it, never tested it, never asked for further information regarding it. But there has been scientific tests done on these codices, correct?
Absolutely right. In fact, 15 in all. And the latest was the test we announced in tandem with the University of Surrey's Iron Beam Centre last week, in fact.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about that. You've had over 15 different tests. Are these independent labs? Are they backed by the Catholic Church, by anything like that, that's got a little bit of skin in the game?
No, we made sure everything was thoroughly independent and thoroughly impartial, because it's the only way to bring about proper impartial scholarship in terms of investigating whether these things are authentic or not. The first question you have to ask yourself is that the lead books, when they were found, they are made of very, very impure lead. It is in such a fragile state that it is virtually cracking and breaking away. I would ask your listeners to go and find a piece of lead, a piece of modern lead, and look at it. Look at how plasticine it is. You can bend it up and down. You can roll it into a ball. You can use it to seal window frames and this and that. But try and get it to crack. Now imagine how long it would take to get lead into such a condition. Therefore, the question that you have to ask is, if the books are fakes, what are they fakes of? Now, this is a question that nobody has actually sought to answer, because after Toneman, we then had a group of academics and self-proclaimed experts who called themselves bibliobloggers, who then hijacked the internet, the Wikipedia page, they denounced the codices as fakes, they called us fakes, and so on and so forth. They wrote letters to media, publishing houses, laboratories, universities, religious institutions, even the Jordanian authorities. I mean, it really was quite a concerted campaign. And finally, we in 2012, we approached the University of Surrey. They too had been approached by the bibliobloggers and threatened. And they said to us, but however, we're going to ignore them. We're going to go ahead with the tests. And we were able to develop a very, very good working relationship with them. They too have seen the data from the other laboratories. And of course, you know, we've been finally able to build up quite a considerable body of information and analysis to show that these things are nothing other than 2,000 years old.
You brought up an interesting point. If these are fakes, what are they fakes of? And I brought up a little bit earlier in the show that, you know, there have been copies of the Bible found and different versions that were kind of spread out and set out so that, you know, if one was destroyed, there were other copies that could be out there. Could there be a possibility that these codices are maybe not the original imprints of this, but the copies that were meant to be hidden away to protect this knowledge and this part of history?
You know, I think you're right there. I think the answer to that is both yes and no. I think that they are definitely copies of older information. I mean, that's what you get from the quotation in Second Esdras. You get, you know, the instruction to write this knowledge down and then to seal the book and then to hide it away in a cave. That's fascinating in itself. But I think furthermore, the people who made these books are trying to get across an express point about their history, about where they stand at that present time, and about their approach to God, to the divine. So I think we have a bit of both. I think they're using older knowledge in order to illustrate who they are. Because of course, we're talking here about, you know, people who believe themselves to be the righteous. In that sense, therefore, they're using these things to embody that.
There's so much that we don't know and we're continually trying to find and understand. It's so fascinating to me how quickly people are willing to denounce things that they know very little about and that they have become quote unquote experts in the field because they've read all of the online articles and submissions by people that they have no way of knowing what their true backgrounds are or what their belief systems are or where they're coming from in this proposal. What can you explain with these scientific tests that have been done? Can you kind of explain to me the process of what goes into looking into something this old and determining that it is originally from that time period, from, you know, that this metal comes from that era, from that location, something? What all is involved in that?
Yeah, in as much as I can, because I'm not okay. An expert on that particular bit of it, but I have to say it's a very, very fascinating process. And I have to say, going back to your original points, you know, unfortunately, the average person or journalist isn't going to know the difference between self-proclaimed experts, such as the bibliobloggers, and proper experts, you know, who are so busy, they're so enamored of what they do that they don't have time to blog and they don't have time to write except the occasional article on what they're doing. And it was the same when we went to the Iron Beam Centre at the University of Surrey. They're very into what they do, and it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, we, in the last test, we actually opened the book that's on loan to us from Jordan, and they decided they would actually test the lead from the inside to see what kind of a state it was in, and to see if they could detect any modern traces. And from what I can understand of the process, we kind of went into this James Bond film set where you had, you know, huge chambers of liquid nitrogen gas here and atomic things here and there, and it was quite extraordinary, really. And they then subjected this book to various tests, and one of those tests is where they throw alpha particles at the sheet lead itself, and then assess what emerges from the reaction. And the result of this was basically that they found no radioactive polonium emitted from the book. So in other words, the book wasn't giving out a radioactive signal. Now, why is that important? Well, this all goes back to 1945, to an event that happened in the New Mexico desert. And of course, that event was the exploding of the first atom bomb. From that moment onwards, we have radioactive polonium in the atmosphere. And of course, from that point onwards, we had a multitude of atom bombs being tested because it was the latest toy for the army and defense industries. So from now on, when you smelt lead or any other metal, polonium will get into it and you can detect it. So it's radioactive. So the very fact that we found none of that in the codex shows that it couldn't have been made in modern times, and it wasn't knocked up by me in my garden shed. So the test showed demonstrably that it is at least 150 to 200 years old. That's as far as they can take it on that side of things. But now, having cleared it of modern radioactive signals, we then look at the corrosion. The metal is extremely impure. As I say, you know, it's not just lead that the books are made of. Within that lead, there's silver, there's tin, there's antimony, and various other things. And over the process of 2,000 years, those impurities have begun to escape from the matrix of the metal. And they've gradually leached out of the cracks and the little pittings that you see under a microscope on the surface. And they've appeared as crystals. And so therefore, you have crystalline chemicals that have escaped from the from inside the metal. A bit like sort of sweat coming from, you know, the surface of the human skin.
Okay.
And of course, you can read these crystals spectrographically and you can see what they are. And some of them are so rare that it can only take about 1,500 years to 2,000 years for them to formulate. And from that, we can get a date. Not specific, but a date, you know, good enough for us to say, yes, with confidence, these things are authentic. And that's precisely what we announced last week.
Let me ask this then, if I may. Just playing the devil's advocate on this before we go to commercial break. Could it not be found that these pieces of metal existed back then and survived all this time, but that the inscriptions themselves and the plating have been manufactured in more recent times, just using old stock?
That's a really good question, and one that's very easily answered. First of all, if that had been remanufactured, it means that they'd have to have been hammered, and you would see the signals of that in the shattering of the crystals. You'd see the trauma on the surface of the lead. On top of that, the writing itself is actually cast. It isn't engraved, so therefore it was cast with the book, and the patina of the books is uniform over all of them, and every single patina is unique to each plate in every single book. Now, in order to formulate crystallization in and corrosion of this type, you would need at least the use of an atomic reactor. So those who say that these were knocked up by Bedouin in the Syrian or Jordanian deserts are kind of giving quite some acclaim to these Bedouin, because A, they have the use of nuclear reactors, B, they know all about, you know, nuclear chemistry, and C, they have the latest up-to-date academic knowledge on the use of Paleo-Hebrew. If we can find those guys, I'd pay them $1 million.
All right, you heard it here on Coast to Coast AM. We're up against the top of the hour break. But don't worry, David's going to be here with us for an entire hour. Plus, we're going to open up phone lines at the bottom of the hour. If you have questions, concerns, thoughts regarding this topic, we'd love to hear from you. And when we do return to the show, I want to know, what do these codices represent to the Christian faith? Should Christians see these as a threat, or should they embrace them? And what is so controversial about what appears inside of them? Why would people be so willing and wanting to dismiss them? That's just part of the journey we have online for you next. So stay tuned. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.